like this in this part of town, hell, they might even have a gun. What's back there, Nikki? Philip shoots a thumb at a curtained doorway in the rear of the store. The black privacy drape hangs down to the floor. You get a chance to check it out. Stockroom is my guess. Be careful, Philly, it's dark back there. Philip pauses by the curtain, shrugs off his backpack, and fishes in it for the small penlight he keeps in the side pocket. He flips it on, and he pushes his way through the drape, vanishing into the gloom. Across the store, Penny is transfixed by the broken dolls and eviscerated teddy bears. Brian watches her closely. He aches to help her, aches to get everybody back on track. But all he can do right now is kneel next to the child and try to keep her distracted. You want one of those candy bars? Nope. It comes out of her like the crackle of a pull-string doll, her eyes fixed on all the busted toys. You sure? Yep. We got Twinkies, Brian tells her, trying to fill the silence, trying to keep her talking, trying to keep her occupied. But right now, all Brian can think about is the look on Philip's face and the violence in his eyes. And the whole world, their world, falling apart. No, I'm okay, Penny says. She sees the little Hello Kitty backpack lying in a pile of trash and she goes over to it. She picks it up, inspects it. You think anybody would get mad if I took some of these things? What things, kiddo? Brian looks at her. You mean the toys? She nods. A stab of sorrow and shame cleaves Brian's midsection. Go for it, he says. She starts gathering up pieces of trampled dolls and tattered stuffed animals. It looks almost like a ritual to Brian. Like a rite of passage for the little girl, as she selects Barbies with missing limbs and teddy bears with torn seams. She slips the injured toys into the knapsack with the care of someone performing triage at a clinic. Brian lets out a sigh. Right then, Philip's voice calls out from somewhere deep in the gut of the back hallway, cutting off Brian's thoughts. He was about to fecklessly offer Penny the sausage stick, and now Brian springs to his feet. What did he say? Across the shop behind the cash register, Nick perks up. I don't know, I didn't hear. Philip? Brian starts toward the back curtain, his flesh crawling with nervous tension. You okay? Hasty footsteps shuffle inside the draped doorway, and all at once the curtain flaps open, and Philip is peering out at them with a wild expression contorting his face, somewhere between excitement and mania. Grab your shit. We just won the Irish fucking sweepstakes. Philip takes them down a narrow, dark corridor, past shelves of unopened toys and games, around a corner, and through a security door apparently left unlocked amid the previous occupants' hurried exodus. Down another narrow hallway, guided by the thin beam of Philip's penlight, and they come to a fire escape. The metal door is slightly ajar, the shadows of a passageway visible on the other side. Get a load of what's on the other side of our little toy store. Philip pushes the fire door open with his boot. Our ticket out of this hellhole. The metal door swings wide, and Brian finds himself staring across another narrow hallway at the mirror image of the first fire door. The metal door across the hall is also ajar, and through the gap, Brian sees, cloaked in shadows, rows of gleaming, spoked wheels. Oh my God, he utters. Is that what I think it is? The space is huge, encompassing the entire corner of the adjacent building's first floor, lined with reinforced window glass on three sides. Visible through the windows is the street corner outside, where shadowy forms wander aimlessly, drifting through the rain like doomed souls. But inside, in the shiny, happy world of Champion Cycle Center, Atlanta's premier motorcycle dealership, all is warm and tidy and polished to a high sheen. The showroom appears to be untouched by the plague. In the wan, overcast light filtering in through the massive display windows, motorcycles of all makes and models are lined up in four neat rows, extending from one end of the dealership to the other. The air smells of new rubber and oiled leather and finely honed steel. The edges of the showroom are carpeted with logo-embroidered pile as lush and new as a fancy hotel lobby. Powerless neon signs hang down at junctures with product legends. Kawasaki, Ducati, Yamaha, Honda, Triumph, Harley-Davidson, and Suzuki. You think any of them have gas in them? Brian turns in a slow 360, taking in the whole of the showroom. We got our pick of the litter, sport. Philip nods toward the rear of the room, past the sales counter and desks and shelves brimming with parts. They got a workspace back there with the garage out back. We can siphon fuel into any one of them things easy enough. Penny stares emotionlessly at the banquet of chrome and rubber. She has the Hello Kitty pack strapped securely to her tiny shoulders. Brian's head is swimming. Contrary emotions crash up against each other like whitecaps. Excitement, anxiety, hope, fear. Only one problem, he utters under his breath, the weight of his anguish and uncertainty pressing down on his shoulders. Philip looks at his brother. What the hell's the problem now? Brian wipes his mouth. I have no idea how to work one of those things. They all have a much-needed laugh. Nervous, brittle laughter, perhaps, but laughter nonetheless, at the expense of Brian. Philip assures his brother that it doesn't make one lick of a difference that Brian has never ridden a motorcycle. A retard could learn it in 2 minutes. More importantly, both Philip and Nick have owned hogs over the years, and the last time Philip checked, there was only 4 of them, so the 2 non-operators can ride along on the saddles. Faster we get out of ATL, the better chances we got with no guns, Philip says, minutes later, rifling through a rack of leathers in the rear corner of the store. Jackets, trousers, vests, and accessories. He chooses a bomber brown Harley jacket and a pair of heavy-duty black boots. I want everybody changed out of their wet clothes and ready to go in 5 minutes. Brian, you help Penny. They get changed as the rain eases up outside the big windows. The street corner crawls with shambling figures now, scores of frayed, tattered souls, some of them scorched from the explosion, others in advanced stages of decomposition. Faces are starting to cave in, some of them dripping with parasites and blackening into moldy masks of putrefied flesh. None of them, however, notices the movement inside the dark showroom. You see them bodies gathering out there? Nick says to Philip under his breath. Nick already has dry clothes on and is zipping up a black leather jacket. He gives a little nod toward the gray light of the storefront. Some of them things are pretty ripe. So? Some of them got what? 3-4 weeks on them? At least. Philip thinks about it for a moment, changing out of his wet denims. His underwear is stuck to him and he has to practically peel it off. He turns away so that Penny doesn't see his package. Whole thing broke out over a month ago, so what? They're rotten. Huh? Nick lowers his voice so that he doesn't catch Penny's ear. The little girl is busying herself across the showroom with a size small winter coat, which Brian is trying to figure out how to snap. Think about it, Philly. The normal course of affairs, a dead body is dust in a year or so. He lowers his voice further. Especially one that's exposed to the elements. What are you saying, Nick? All we gotta do is wait out the clock? Let the maggots do the work? Nick shrugs. Well, yeah. I guess I just thought, listen to me. Philip jabs a finger in Nick's face. Keep your theories to yourself. I didn't mean to. They ain't going away, Nicky. Get that through your thick fucking skull. I don't want my daughter hearing any of this shit. They eat, they live in, and they reproduce. And when they rot away, there's gonna be more of them to take their place. And judging from the fact that old man Chalmers turned without even getting bit, the whole goddamn world's days are numbered. So drink up, Bubba. It's later than y'all think. Nick looks down. All right, man, I get it. Cool down, Philly. At this point, Brian has Penny bundled up and the two of them come over. We're as ready as we'll ever be. What time you got? Philip asks Brian, who looks semi-ridiculous in a Harley leather jacket that's a size and a half too big for him. He looks at his watch. Almost noon? Good. Gives us a good 6-7 hours of daylight to get the hell out of Dodge. You guys pick out your bikes? Brian asks. Philip gives him a cold smile. They choose two of the biggest metal masterpieces in the place. A couple of Harley-Davidson Electra Glides, one in pearl blue and the other in midnight black. They choose them for the size of the engines, the roominess of the seats, the cubic inches of storage space, and also because, hey, they're fucking Harleys. Philip decides that Penny will ride with him and Brian will ride with Nick. The gas tanks are empty, but several bikes in the repair garage in the rear have fuel in them, so they siphon as much as they can into the Harleys. Over the course of the 15 minutes it takes them to get the bikes ready and find helmets that fit and transfer all their belongings into the luggage carriers, the street outside the front of the place grows hectic with dead. Hundreds of biters crowd the intersection now, wandering aimlessly in the gray drizzle, brushing against the glass, groaning their rusty groans, drooling their black bile, fixing their powder-colored eyes on the moving shadows inside the windows of Champion Cycle Center. "It's busy out there," Nick mumbles to no one in particular as he rolls the massive two-wheeler toward the side exit, where a small vertical garage door faces the parking lot along the side of the dealership. He straps on his helmet. "Element of surprise," Philip says, pushing his black Harley over to the door. His stomach growls with hunger and nerves as he puts on his helmet. He hasn't eaten in nearly 24 hours. None of them has. He shoves the iron rod from the bus into a seam between the handlebars and windscreen for quick and easy access. "Come on, Pumpkin, hop on," he says to Penny, who stands sheepishly nearby with a kitty helmet on. "You want to take a little spin? Get out of this place." Brian helps the child climb up onto the rear seat, a padded perch above the black lacquer luggage compartment. There's a safety belt in one of the side compartments, and Brian snaps it around the little girl's waist. "Don't worry, kiddo," he says softly to her. "Gonna head south and then west, y'all," Philip says as he mounts the iron beast. "Nicky, you follow me."
"Copy that."
"Everybody ready?" Brian goes over to the door and gives a nervous nod.
"Ready."
Philip kicks the Harley to life, the engine howling and filling the dark showroom with noise and fumes. Nick kicks his bike on. The second engine sings a noisy aria in dissonant unison with the first. Philip revs the throttle and gives Brian the high sign. Brian jacks the manual lock on the door and then throws it open, letting in the wet wind. Philip kicks the gear and takes off. Brian leaps onto the back of Nick's bike, and they blast off after Philip.
"Oh, shit! Oh, God! Philip! Philip, look down! Look down, man! Philip, look down!"
Brian's frantic wail is muffled by his helmet and drowned by the noise of the cycles. It happens mere moments after they slam through a mass of biters choking the intersection, the ragged bodies bouncing off their fenders. After making a hard left turn and zooming south on Water Street, leaving the throngs in their dust and fumes, Brian sees the mangled corpse dragging along the pavement behind Philip's bike. The bottom half of the thing is torn away, its intestines like electrical wiring flagging in the wind, but the torso still has fight left in it, its moldering head still intact. With its two dead arms, it clings to the rear fenders and it starts pulling itself up the side of the Harley. The worst part is, neither Philip nor Penny seem to be aware of it.
"Pull alongside him! Nick, pull up!"
Brian screams, his arms clutched around Nick's midsection.
"I'm trying!"
At this point, roaring down the deserted, wet side street, the bike hydroplaning on slick pavement, Penny notices the creature stuck to the bike, clawing its way toward her, and she starts screaming. From Brian's vantage point, 30 feet behind her, the child's scream is inaudible, like an exaggerated gesture of a silent movie actress. Nick opens up the throttle. His Harley closes the distance.
"Grab the bat!"
he screams over the din, and Brian tries to root the baseball bat out from beneath the luggage carrier behind him. Up ahead, almost without warning, Philip Blake notices the thing attached to the back of his bike. Philip's helmet cocks around quickly as he gropes for his weapon. By this point, Nick is within 5 or 6 feet of the black Harley's taillights, but before Brian can intercede with the bat, he sees Philip drawing the iron rod from its makeshift scabbard on the front of his bike. With a quick and violent motion, which causes the black Harley to veer slightly off course, Philip twists around in his seat, one-handing the handlebars, and thrusts the hooked end of the metal rod into the zombie's mouth. The skewered head of the monster gets stuck inches below Penny, the rod wedged between the gleaming exhaust pipes. Philip draws his right leg up and, with the force of a battering ram, he kicks the corpse, rod and all, off the bike. The thing tumbles and rolls, and Nick has to swerve suddenly to avoid it. Philip increases his speed, staying on course, heading south, not even bothering to look back. They continue on, zigzagging through the south side of town, avoiding the congested areas. A mile down the road, Philip manages to find another main artery that's relatively clear of wreckage and roaming dead, and he leads them down it. They are now 3 miles from the Atlanta city limits. The horizon line is clear, the sky lightening slightly to the west. They have enough gas to get 400 miles without refueling. Whatever awaits them out there in the gray rural countryside has to be better than what they suffered through in Atlanta. It has to be. Part 3. Chaos Theory. No man chooses evil because it is evil. He only mistakes it for happiness, the good he seeks. Mary Wollstonecraft. Chapter 17. Around Hartsfield Airport, the rain lets up, leaving behind a scoured, metallic sky of low clouds and dismal cold. It feels terrific, however, to get this far in less than an hour. Highway 85 is far less wreckage blocking its lanes than Interstate 20, and the population of dead has thinned considerably. Most roadside buildings are still intact, their windows and doors battened and secured. The stray dead walking about here and there almost seem like part of the landscape now, blending into the skeletal trees like a ghastly fungus infecting the woods. The land itself seems to have turned. The towns themselves are dead. Riding through this area leaves one with more of an impression of desolation than the end of the world. The only immediate problem is the fact that every abandoned filling station or truck stop is infested with biters, and Brian is getting very concerned about Penny. At every pit stop, either to take a leak or to forage for food or water, her face seems more drawn, her tiny little tulip lips more cracked. Brian's worried she's getting dehydrated. Hell, he's worried they're all getting dehydrated. Empty stomachs are one thing. They can go without food for extended lengths of time. But the lack of water is becoming a serious issue. 10 miles southwest of Hartsfield, as the landscape begins to transition into patchworks of pine forests and soybean farms, Brian is wondering if they could drink the water from the motorcycle's radiators, when he sees a green directional sign looming up ahead with a blessed message. Rest area, 1 mile. Philip gives them a signal to pull off, and they take the next exit ramp. As they roar uphill and into the lot, which is bordered by a small wood-framed tourist center, the relief spreads through Brian like a salve. The place is mercifully deserted, free of any signs of the living or the dead. What really happened back there, Philip? Brian sits on a picnic table situated on a small promontory of grass behind the rest area shack. Philip paces, sucking down a bottle of Evian that he wrested from a broken vending machine. Nick and Penny are 50 yards away, still within view. Nick is gently spinning Penny on a ramshackle old merry-go-round under a diseased live oak. The girl just sits on the thing, joylessly, like a gargoyle, staring straight out as she turns and turns and turns. I told you once already to give that a rest, Philip grumbles.
I think you, like, owe me an answer.
I don't owe you shit.
Something happened that night, Brian persists. He isn't afraid of his brother anymore.
He knows Philip could beat the shit out of him at any moment. The potential for violence between the Blakes seems more imminent now than ever. But Brian doesn't care anymore. Something deep within Brian Blake has shifted like a seismic plate changing with the landscape. If Philip wants to wring Brian's throat, so be it.
Something between you and April?
Philip gets very still and looks down.
What the fuck difference does it make?
It makes a big difference. It does to me. Our lives are on the line here. We got a pretty fair chance of surviving back there at that place. And then just like that, poof! Philip looks up.
his eyes fix themselves on his brother, and something very dark passes between the two men.
Drop it, Brian. Just tell me one thing. You seem so hell-bent to get out of there. Do you have a plan?
What do you mean?
Do you have, like, a strategy? Any idea where the hell we're headed? What are you, a fucking tour guide? What if the biters get thick again? We basically got a piece of wood to fight him with. We'll find something else. Where are we going, Philip?
Philip turns away and lifts the collar of his leather bomber, staring out at the ribbon of pavement snaking off into the western horizon.
Another month or so, winter's gonna set in. I'm thinking we stay moving, heading southwest, toward the Mississippi.
Where's that gonna get us?
It's the easiest way to go south.
And? Philip turns and looks at Brian, a mixture of purpose and anguish crossing Philip's deeply lined face, as though he doesn't really believe what he's saying.
We'll find a place to live, long term, in the sun. Someplace like Mobile or Biloxi, New Orleans maybe, I don't know, someplace warm. And we'll live there.
Brian lets out an exhausted sigh.
Sounds so easy. Just head south. You got a better plan, I'm all ears.
Long-term plans are like a luxury I haven't even thought about.
We'll make it.
We gotta find some food, Philip. I'm really worried about Penny getting some nourishment.
You let me do the worrying about my daughter.
She won't even eat a Twinkie. Can you believe that? A kid who doesn't want a Twinkie.
Cockroach food. Philip grunts. Can't say I blame her. We'll find something. She's gonna be okay. She's a tough little thing. Like her mother.
Brian can't argue with that. Lately, the little girl has shown miraculous spirit. In fact, Brian has started wondering whether Penny might actually be the glue that's holding them all together, keeping them from self-destructing. He glances across the rest area and sees Penny Blake dreamily spinning on that rusty merry-go-round in the little scabrous playground area. Nick has lost his enthusiasm for turning it, and now just gives it little incremental nudges with his boot. Beyond the playground, the land rises up to an overgrown wooded knoll, where a small, windswept cemetery sits in the pale sun. Brian notices that Penny is talking to Nick, grilling him about something. Brian wonders what the two of them are talking about, that is, the girl looking so worried.
Uncle Nick?
Penny's little face is tight with concern as she slowly turns on the merry-go-round. She's called Nick Uncle for years, even though she knows very well he's not her real uncle. The affectation has always given Nick a secret twinge of longing, the desire to be somebody's real uncle.
Yeah, honey?
A leaden feeling of doom presses down on Nick Parsons as he absently pushes Penny on the merry-go-round. He can see the Blake brothers in his peripheral vision arguing about something.
Is my dad mad at me?
The little girl asks. Nick does a double take. Penny looks down as she slowly spins. Nick measures his words.
Of course not. He's not mad at you. What do you mean? Why would you even think that? He doesn't talk to me as much as he used to.
Nick gently pulls the merry-go-round to a stop. The little girl jerks slightly back against the bar. Nick tenderly pats her on the shoulder.
Listen, I promise you, your daddy loves you more than anything else in the world. I know. He's under a lot of pressure, that's all. You don't think he's mad at me?
No way.
He loves you something fierce, Penny, believe me. He's just under a lot of pressure.
Yeah, I guess so.
We all are.
Yeah.
I'm sure none of us have been talking all that much lately.
Uncle Nick?
Yeah, sweetie?
Do you think Uncle Brian's mad at me?
God, no. Why would Uncle Brian be mad at you?
Maybe because he's got to carry me all the time?
Nick smiles sadly. He studies the look on the girl's face, her little brow all furrowed with seriousness. He strokes her cheek.
Listen to me.
You are the bravest little girl I ever met. I mean that. You are a Blake girl. And that's something to be proud of. She thinks about this and smiles. You know what I'm gonna do? Nah, honey, tell me. I'm gonna fix all them broken dolls. You'll see. I'm gonna fix them. Nick grins at her. That sounds like a plan. The little girl's smile is something that Nick Parsons wondered if he would ever see again. A moment later, on the other side of the rest area, among the picnic tables, Brian Blake sees something out of the corner of his eye. 100 yards away, beyond the playground, amid the crumbling headstones, long-faded markers, and tattered plastic flowers, something moves. Brian locks his gaze on 3 distant figures emerging from the shadows of the trees. Shuffling along in haphazard formation, they approach like lazy bloodhounds smelling the kill. It's hard to tell at this distance, but they look as though their clothes have been fed through a reaper, their mouths hanging open in perpetual torment. Time to get our asses in gear, Philip says with very little urgency, and he starts toward the playground with a kind of heavy, mechanical stride. As he hurries after him, it occurs to Brian, just for an instant, that the way his brother is walking, his muscular arms limp at his sides, the weight of the world on his shoulders, he could very easily, from a distance, be mistaken for a zombie himself. They put more miles behind them. They skirt small towns as empty and still as dioramas in a vast museum. The blue light of dusk starts pulling its shade down on the overcast sky, the wind turning bitter against their visors as they weave around wrecks and deserted trailers, working their way west on 85. Brian starts thinking that they need to find a place to spend the night. Perched on the saddle behind Nick, his eyes watering, his ears deafened by the wind and the roar of the Harley's twin-cam engine, Brian has plenty of time to imagine the perfect place for the weary traveler in the land of the dead. He imagines an enormous, sprawling fortress with gardens and walks and impenetrable moats and security fences and guard towers. He would give his left nut for a steak and French fries, or a bottle of Coke, or even some of the Chalmers' mystery meat. A reflection off the inside of his helmet visor interrupts the flow of his thoughts. He glances over his shoulder. Strange. For the briefest instant there, at the precise same moment he saw a dark blot blur across the inside of his visor, he thought he felt something on the back of his neck. A faint sensation like the kiss of cold lips. It might just be his imagination, but he also thought he saw something flicker across the side mirror, just for an instant, right before they began banking to the south. He gazes over his shoulder and sees nothing behind them but empty lanes tumbling away, receding into the distance and then vanishing around the curve. He shrugs and turns back to his rambling, chaotic thoughts. They venture deeper into the rural hinterlands, until they see nothing but miles and miles of broken-down farms and unincorporated boonies. The rolling hills of bean fields plunge down steep moraines on either side of the highway. This is old land. Prehistoric, tired, worked to death by generations. Carcasses of old machinery lie dormant everywhere, buried in kudzu and mud. Dusk starts settling into night, the sky fading from pale gray to a deep indigo. It's after 7 o'clock now, and Brian has completely forgotten about the peculiar flash of movement reflecting off the inside of his visor. They need to find cover. Philip's headlamp comes on, flinging a shaft of silver light into the gathering shadows. Brian is about to shout something about finding a hideout when he sees Philip signaling up ahead, a stiff wave and then a gloved finger jabbing to the right. Brian glances off to the north and sees what his brother is pointing at. Way off in the distant rolling farmland, rising above a prominence of trees, the silhouette of a house is visible. So far away it looks like a delicate cutout of black construction paper. If Philip hadn't pointed it out, Brian never would have noticed it. But now he sees why it has sunk a hook into Philip. It looks like a grand old relic of the 19th century. Maybe even the 18th century, probably once a plantation house. Brian sees another flicker of dark movement out of the corner of his eye, flashing across the side mirror, something behind them, passing just for a fraction of a second through the outer edges of his vision. Then it's gone, vanishing as Brian twists around in his seat to gaze over his shoulder. They take the next exit and boom down a dusty dirt road. As they close in on the house, which sits all by its lonesome at the crest of a vast foothill at least half a mile off the highway, Brian shivers in the cold. He has a terrible feeling all of a sudden, despite the fact that the closer they get to the farmhouse, the more inviting it looks. This area of Georgia is known for its orchards, peaches, figs, and plums, and as they roar up a winding drive that leads to the house, they see that it's an aging beauty. Surrounded by peach trees, which spread off into the distance like the spokes of a wheel, the central building is a massive two-story brick pile with ornate garrets and dormers rising off the roof. It has the flavor of an old, decrepit Italian villa. The porch is a 50-foot-long portico with columns, balustrades, and mullioned windows choking with vines of brown ivy and bougainvillea. In the fading light, it looks almost like a ghost ship from some pre-Civil War armada. The noise and fumes of the Harleys swirl in the dusty air as Philip leads them across the front lot, which is bordered by a massive, decorative fountain made of marble and masonry. Apparently fallen into disrepair, the fountain has a film of scum across its basin. Several outbuildings, stables perhaps, lie off to the right. A tractor lies half buried in crabgrass. To the left of the front facade sits a massive carriage house, big enough for six cars. None of this antique opulence registers with Brian as they cautiously pull up to a side door between the garage and the main house. Philip brings his Harley to a stop in a thunderhead of dust, revving the motor for a moment. He kills the engine and sits there, staring up at the salmon-colored brick monstrosity. Nick pulls next to him and snaps down his kickstand. They don't say a word for the longest time. Finally, Philip lowers his stand, dismounts, and says to Penny, "Stay here for a second, Pumpkin." Nick and Brian dismount. "You got that baseball bat handy?" Philip says without even looking at them. "You think there's anybody in there?" Nick asks. "Only one way to find out." Philip waits for Nick to go around the back of his Electra Glide and fetch the bat, which is sheathed down one side of his luggage carrier. He brings it back and hands it over. "You two stay with Penny," Philip says, and starts toward the portico. Brian stops him, grabbing his arm. "Philip." Brian is about to say something about dark shapes flashing across a side mirror back on the highway, but he stops himself. He's not sure he wants Penny to hear this. "The hell's the matter with you?" Philip says. Brian swallows air. "I think there's somebody following us." The former occupants of the villa are long gone. In fact, the inside of the place looks as though it's been sitting empty since long before the plague broke out. Yellowed sheets cover the antique furniture. The many rooms are empty, dusty chambers frozen in time. A grandfather clock still ticks stubbornly in a parlor. Niceties of a bygone era festoon the house. Ornate moldings and French doors and circular staircases and two separate and massive fireplaces with hearths the size of walk-in closets. Under one sheet sits a grand piano, under another a Victrola, under another a wood-burning stove. Philip and Nick sweep the upper floors for biters and find nothing other than more dusty relics of the Old South. A library, a corridor of oil paintings of Confederate generals in gilded frames, a nursery with a dusty old cradle dating back to colonial times. The kitchen is surprisingly small, another holdover from the 19th century when only servants dirtied their hands with cooking, but the enormous pantry has shelves brimming with dusty canned goods. The dry grains and cereals are all mealy and crawling with worms, but the array of fruits and vegetables is staggering. "You're seeing things, sport," Philip says under his breath that night in front of a crackling fire in the front parlor. They found piles of cordwood in the backyard by the barn, and now they've managed to warm their bones for the first time since leaving Atlanta. the warmth and shelter of the villa, as well as the nourishment of canned peaches and okra, caused Penny to instantly doze off. She now slumbers on a luxurious down comforter in the nursery on the second floor. Nick sleeps in the room next to her. But the two brothers have insomnia.
Who the hell would bother following us anyway? Philip adds, taking another sip of the expensive cooking sherry he found in the pantry.
I'm telling you, I saw what I saw, Brian says, nervously rocking on a bentwood chair on the other side of the fire.
He's got a dry shirt on and a pair of sweatpants, and he feels almost human again. He looks over at his brother and sees that Philip is staring intensely at the fire, as though it holds a secret coded message. For some reason, the sight of Philip's gaunt, troubled face reflecting the flicker of firelight breaks Brian's heart. He flashes back to epic childhood journeys into the woods, overnight stays in pup tents and cabins. He remembers having his first beer with his brother, back when Philip was only 10 and Brian was 13. And he remembers Philip being able to drink him under the table even then.
It might have been a car, Brian goes on. Or maybe a van, I'm not sure, but I swear to God, I saw it back there just for a second. And it sure as hell seemed like it was tailing us.
So what if there is somebody following us who gives a rat's ass?
Brian thinks about it for a second.
The only thing is, if they were friendly, wouldn't they, like, catch up with us, signal to us?
Who knows? Philip stares at the fire, his thoughts elsewhere.
Whoever they are, if they're out there, chances are they're as fucked up as us.
That's true, I guess.
Brian thinks about it some more.
Maybe they're just scared. Maybe they're, like, checking us out.
Ain't nobody gonna be able to sneak up on us up here, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I guess.
Brian knows exactly what his brother is talking about. The location and position of the villa is ideal. Situated on a rise that overlooks miles of thinning trees, the house has sight lines that would give them plenty of warning. Even on a moonless night, the orchards are so still and quiet that nobody would be able to creep up on them without being heard or seen. And Philip is already talking about setting booby-trap wires around the periphery to alert them to intruders. On top of that, the place offers them all sorts of benefits that could sustain them for quite a while, maybe even into the winter. There's a well out back, gas in the tractor, a place to hide the Harleys, miles of fruit trees still bearing edible, albeit frost-shriveled fruit, and enough wood to keep the stoves and fireplaces going for months. The only problem is their lack of weapons. They scoured the villa and only found a few implements in the barn, a rusty old scythe, a pitchfork, but no firearms.
You okay?
Brian says after a long stretch of silence.
Fit as a fucking fiddle.
You sure?
Yes, Grandma.
Philip stares into the fire.
We're all gonna be fit as fucking fiddles after a few days in this place.
Philip,
what is it now?
Can I say something?
Here it comes.
Philip doesn't take his eyes off the fire. He wears his wife beater and a dry pair of jeans. His socks have holes in them, his big toe showing through one of them. The sight of this in the firelight, Philip's gnarled toenail sticking out, is heart-rending for Brian. It makes his brother seem, maybe for the first time ever, almost vulnerable. It's highly unlikely that any of them would be alive right now if it weren't for Philip. Brian swallows back his emotion.
I'm your brother, Philip.
I'm aware of that, Brian.
No, what I'm saying is, I don't judge you. I never will.
What's your point?
Point is, I appreciate what you've been doing. Risking your ass protecting us. I want you to know this. I appreciate it.
Philip doesn't say anything, but the way he's staring at that fire begins to change a little bit. He starts gazing beyond it, the flames making his eyes glimmer with emotion.
I know you're a good person, Brian goes on. I know this.
A brief pause here.
I can tell something is eating at you.
Brian, wait a minute, just hear me out. The conversation has crossed a Rubicon, now beyond the point of no return.
If you don't want to tell me what happened back there with you and April, that's fine. I'll never ask you again.
There's a long pause.
But you can tell me, Philip. You can tell me because I'm your brother.
Philip turns and looks at Brian. A single tear tracks down Philip's chiseled, leathery face. It makes Brian's stomach clench. He can't remember ever having seen his brother cry, even as a child. One time, their daddy whipped 12-year-old Philip unmercifully with a hickory switch, raising so many welts on Philip's backside that he had to spend nights sleeping on his stomach. But he never cried. Almost out of spite, he refused to cry. But now, as he meets Brian's gaze in the flickering shadows, Philip's voice is drained as he says,
I fucked up, sport.
Brian nods, says nothing, just waits. Fire crackles and sizzles. Philip looks down.
I think I sort of fell for her.
The tear drips on him, but his voice never breaks, it just remains flat and weak.
Ain't gonna say it was love, but what the fuck is love anyway? Love is a fucking disease.
He cringes at some demon twisting in him.
I fucked up, Brian. Could have had something with her. Could have had something solid for Penny, something good.
He grimaces, as though holding off a tide of sorrow, tears welling up in his eyes until every time he blinks, they run down his face.
I couldn't stop myself. She said stop, but I couldn't do it. Couldn't stop. See, the thing is, it felt so goddamn good.
Tears dripping.
Even when she was pushing me away, it felt good.
Silence.
What the fuck is wrong with me?
More silence.
I know there ain't no excuse for it.
Pause.
I'm not stupid, I just didn't think I would ever. I didn't think I could. I didn't think.
His voice crumbles until there's nothing but the crackle of the fire and the huge dark silence outside the villa. At length, after an interminable period of time, Philip looks up at his brother. In the dancing light, Brian sees that the tears are spent. Nothing but barren anguish remains on Philip Blake's face. Brian doesn't say a word. He simply nods. The next few days take them into November, and they decide to stay put and see what the weather does. A freezing sleet sweeps across the orchards one morning. On another day, a killer frost grips the fields and takes down much of the fruit. But for all the signs of winter rolling in, they feel no compulsion to leave just yet. The villa might be their best bet to wait out the harsh days on the horizon. They've got enough canned goods and fruit, if they're careful, to keep them going for months, and enough wood to keep them warm. And the orchards seem relatively free of biters, at least in the immediate vicinity. In some ways, Philip seems to be doing better now that the burden of his guilt has been offloaded. Brian keeps the secret to himself, thinking about it often but never broaching the subject again. The two brothers are less edgy with each other, and even Penny seems to be settling in nicely to this new routine that they're carving out for themselves. She finds an antique dollhouse in an upper parlor and stakes out a little place for herself and all her broken misfit toys at the end of the second-floor hallway. Brian comes up there one day and finds all the dolls lying in neat little rows on the floor, all the severed appendages lying next to their corresponding bodies. He stares for quite a long while at the strange miniature morgue before Penny snaps him out of his daze.
Come on, Uncle Brian, she says. You can be a doctor. Help me put them back together.
Yeah, that's a good idea, he says with a nod. Let's put them back together.
On another occasion, early in the morning, Brian hears a sound coming from the first floor. He goes down to the kitchen
and finds Penny standing on a chair covered in flour and gunk, fiddling with pots and pans, her hair matted with makeshift pancake batter. The kitchen is a disaster area. The others arrive, and the three men just stand there in the doorway of the kitchen staring.
"Don't be mad," Penny says, glancing over her shoulder. "I promise I'll clean up the mess."
The men look at each other. Philip, grinning now for the first time in weeks, says, "Who's mad?"
"We ain't mad. We're just hungry. When's breakfast gonna be ready?"
As the days pass, they take precautions. They decide to burn firewood only at night when the smoke can't be seen from the highway. Philip and Nick construct a perimeter of baling wire stretched between small wooden stakes at each corner of the property, placing tin cans at key junctures to alarm them of possible intruders, biters and human alike. They even find an old antique double-barrel 12-gauge in the villa's attic. The shotgun is filmed in dust and engraved with cherubs, and looks as if it might blow up in their faces if they tried to fire the thing. They don't even have any shells for it. The gun looks like the kind of thing somebody would hang in their study on the wall next to old photographs of Ernest Hemingway. But Philip sees some value in having it around. It looks threatening enough. On a galloping horse, as his dad used to say. "You never know," Philip says one night, leaning the shotgun against the hearth and settling back to numb himself with more cooking sherry. The days continue to slip away with shapeless regularity. They catch up on their sleep, and they explore the orchards, and they harvest fruit. They set box traps for stray critters, and one day they even catch a scrawny jackrabbit. Nick volunteers to clean the thing, and he ends up making a fairly decent braised rabbit on the wood stove that night. They have only a few encounters with biters during this time. One day, Nick is halfway up a tree, reaching for some withered plums, when he sees a walking corpse in farmer's overalls way off in the shadows of a neighboring grove. He calmly climbs down and sneaks up on the thing with his pitchfork, skewering the back of its head as though popping a balloon. On another occasion, Philip is siphoning gas from a tractor when he notices a mangled corpse in a nearby drainage ditch, legs smashed and contorted underneath it. The woman thing looks like it dragged itself miles to get here. Philip chops off its head with a scythe and burns the remains with a squirt of gas and a spark of a Bic. Piece of cake. All the while, the villa seems to be adopting them as much as they are adopting it. With all the sheets removed from the opulent old furniture, it seems almost like a place they could call home. They each have their own room now, and although they're each still plagued by nightmares, there's nothing more soothing than coming down to an old, elegant kitchen with the November sun streaming through French windows and the fragrance of a coffee pot that's been simmering all night. In fact, if it weren't for the periodic feelings of being watched, things would be pretty close to perfect. The feelings began to intensify for Brian as early as the second night they were there. Brian had just moved into his own bedroom on the second floor, an austere sewing parlor with a quaint little four-poster bed and an 18th-century armoire, when he sprang awake in the middle of the night. He'd been dreaming that he was a castaway, adrift on a makeshift raft on a sea of blood, when he saw a flash of light. In the dream, he thought it might be a distant lighthouse on some distant shore, summoning him, rescuing him from this endless plague of blood. But when he awakened, he realized he had just seen actual light in the waking world, just for a second, a rectangular slice of light sliding across the ceiling. In a blink, it was gone. He wasn't even sure he had actually seen it, but every fiber of his being told him to get up and go to the window. He did, and gazing out of the black void of the night, he could have sworn he caught a glimpse of a car, a quarter mile away, turning around at the point where the highway met the farm road. Then the thing vanished, sliding into nothingness. Brian found it exceedingly difficult to get any more sleep that night. When he told Philip and Nick about it the next morning, they simply wrote it off as a dream. Who the hell would pull off the highway and then turn around and take off? But the suspicion grew in Brian over that next week and a half. At night, he kept catching glimpses of slowly moving lights out on the highway or on the far side of the orchard. Some nights, in the wee hours,
He could swear that he was hearing the crunch of tires on gravel. The furtive, fleeting quality of these sounds was the worst part. It gave Brian the feeling that somehow the villa was being cased. But he got so tired of having his paranoid suspicion dismissed by the others that he simply stopped reporting it. Maybe he was imagining all of it. He didn't say another word on the matter until the 2-week anniversary of their stay in the villa, when, at a point just before dawn, the sound of tin cans rattling stirred him from a deep sleep. Chapter 18.
What the hell?
Brian snaps awake in the darkness of his room. He fumbles for one of the kerosene lanterns on his bedside table, knocking over the hurricane glass and spilling fluid. He gets up and goes to the window, the floor icy on the soles of his bare feet. Moonlight shines down from a crystalline, cold autumn night sky, lining every shape outside with a luminous halo of silver. Brian can still hear the tin cans on the tripwires rattling out there somewhere. He can also hear the others stirring in their bedrooms behind him down the hall. Everybody is up now, awakened by the jangling cans. The strangest part is, and Brian wonders if he's imagining this, the rattling sounds are coming from all directions. Tin cans are clattering in the groves behind the villa as well as in front of it. Brian is craning his neck to see better when his bedroom door bursts open.
Sport, you up?
Philip is shirtless, wearing jeans and logger boots that he hasn't had a chance to tie yet. He holds the old shotgun with one hand, his eyes wide open with alarm.
I'm gonna need you to go get that pitchfork in the back hallway. Pronto!
Is it biters? Just get moving!
Brian gives a nod and hurries out of the room, his brain swimming with panic. He wears only his sweatpants and a sleeveless t-shirt. As he pants through the darkness of the house, down the stairs, across the parlor, and into the back hall, he senses movement outside the windows, the presence of others closing in on them from outside. Grabbing the pitchfork, which leans against the back door, Brian whirls and heads back to the front room. By this point, Philip, Nick, and even Penny have reached the bottom of the steps. They go to the front bay window, which offers a wide-angle view of the surrounding yards, the sloping drive down to the adjacent road, and even the edge of the closest orchard. Immediately, they see dark shapes, low to the ground, sliding across the property from 3 different directions.
Are those cars?
Nick utters in barely a whisper. As their eyes adjust to the moonlit night, they each realize that yes, indeed, those are cars moving slowly across the property toward the villa. One comes up the winding drive, another one from the north end of the orchard, a third just visible to the south, crunching slowly over the gravel path leading out of the trees. Almost with perfect synchronous timing, each vehicle suddenly stops at an equidistant point from the house. They sit there for a second, each one maybe 50 feet away, their windows too dark to reveal their occupants.
This ain't no welcome wagon, Philip murmurs, the understatement of the evening.
Again, almost in perfect concurrence, each pair of headlights suddenly snaps on. The effect is fairly dramatic, almost theatrical, in fact, as the beams strike the windows of the villa, filling the dark interior with cold, chromium light. Philip is about to go outside and make a stand with the defunct shotgun when the sound of a crash is heard coming from the rear of the villa.
Punkin, you stay with Brian, Philip says to Penny.
Then he shoots a glance at Nick.
Nicky, I want you to see if you can slip out a side window. Take the machete. Double back on him if you can. You follow me?
Nick understands exactly what he's saying, and he takes off down the side hallway.
Stay behind me, but stay close.
Philip raises the shotgun, the butt against his shoulder. Carefully and focused with cobra-like calm, Philip shuffles commando style toward the sound of footsteps on broken glass, now coming from the kitchen.
Nice and easy does it, hoss, the home invader says in a cheerful Tennessee twang, raising the barrel of a 9mm Glock as Philip enters the kitchen with the shotgun also raised.
Before being so rudely interrupted, the intruder had been calmly looking around the kitchen as though he had just climbed out of bed for a midnight snack. Headlamps, coming from outside, pierced the room with harsh radiance. The pane of glass above the doorknob behind the man is busted in, and the faint light of dawn is just beginning to glow. Well over 6 feet tall, dressed in shop-worn camo pants, muddy jack boots, and a blood-soaked Kevlar flak vest, the home invader is completely bald, with a scarred, missile-shaped head and eyes like craters cut by tiny meteors. On closer scrutiny, he looks sick, like he's been exposed to radiation, his jaundiced skin mottled with sores. Philip points the worthless antique shotgun at the bald man's cranium, about 8 feet between the two men, and Philip concentrates on pretending, maybe even believing, that the shotgun is loaded.
"I'll give you all the benefit of the doubt," Philip says. "I'll assume you thought the place was empty."
"That's exactly right, Hoss," the bald man says, his voice calm, maybe medicated, like that of a dreamy disc jockey. His teeth are capped in gold, and they shimmer dully as he smiles a reptilian smile.
"So we'll thank you all just to leave us be. No harm, no foul."
The man with the Glock apes a hurt frown.
"Now, that ain't too neighborly of you?"
The man has a slight tremor, a tick, percolating with latent violence.
"I see y'all got a cute little thing back there."
"Never mind that." Philip stands his ground. He can hear the front door squeak, footsteps crossing the parlor. His brain crashes with panic and warring impulses. He knows the next few seconds are critical, maybe even mortally so. But all he can think of doing is to stall.
"We don't want any bloodshed. And brother, I guarantee you, no matter what happens, yours and mine's gonna be the first blood that's shed."
"Smooth talker." The bald man calls out suddenly to one of his comrades in the dark.
"Shorty?"
A voice answers from outside the back door.
"Got him, Tommy."
Almost on cue, Nick appears outside the jagged window of the back door, a large bowie knife held against his windpipe. His captor, a skinny kid with pimples and a marine jarhead haircut, pushes open the door and shoves Nick into the kitchen.
"I'm sorry, Philly,"
Nick says as he shoved against the cabinets, hard enough to steal his breath. The slender young man with the crew cut holds the knife against Nick's Adam's apple, a machete thrust down the young man's belt. A jittery, bony specimen with fingerless Carnaby gloves on his hands, the skinny kid looks like an escapee from a marine brig. His fatigue jacket has the sleeves torn off, and his long, bare arms riddled with jailhouse hieroglyph.
"Hold on now," Philip says to the bald man. "There's no reason to—"
"Sonny!"
The bald man calls out to another accomplice at the precise same moment Philip hears the footsteps creaking across the 100-year-old hardwood floor out in the front parlor. Philip keeps the shotgun raised and aimed, but shoots a quick side glance back over his shoulder. Brian and Penny huddle in the shadows directly behind Philip, maybe 5 feet off his heels. Two more figures have suddenly appeared behind Brian and Penny, making the little girl jump.
"Got it covered, Tommy,"
says one of the figures as the steel-plated barrel of a large-caliber revolver, maybe a .357 Magnum, maybe an Army 45, becomes visible for all to see, pressing against the back of Brian Blake's skull. Brian stiffens like a cornered animal.
"Hold on now," Philip says.
In his peripheral vision, he can see that the two figures holding guns on Brian and Penny are a man and a woman, although he would use the word woman loosely in this case. The gal clutching a piece of Penny's collar is an androgynous marionette of skin and bones, clad in leather pants and layers of mesh, with lamp black eyeliner, spiky hair, and the slightly greenish pallor of a junkie. She nervously taps the barrel of a .38 police special against the shank of her beanpole thigh. The man next to her, the one apparently named Sonny, also looks as though he's no stranger to the needle. His sunken eyes stare out from a pockmarked mask of ignorance and meanness, his emaciated form clad in army surplus rags.
"I want to thank you, brother,"
the bald man says, shoving his 9mm back into its belt sheath, acting like the showdown has now officially ended.
"You dug up quite a spot here, I'll give you that."
He goes over to the sink and calmly helps himself to the jug of well water sitting on the counter, quaffing down an entire glassful.
This'll do nicely as a home base.
That's all well and good, Philip says, not making any move to lower his faux weapon.
Well, the problem is, we can't take on any more people.
That's okay, brother.
Then what exactly are you planning to... What are your intentions?
Our intentions?
The bald man enunciates the word with mock profundity.
Our intentions are to take this place from y'all.
Somebody that Philip can't see snickers with great amusement. Philip's brain is a fractured chessboard, pieces moving now in herky-jerky motion. He knows that it's likely these hardened road rats mean to kill him and everybody else in the house. He knows they're parasites, and they've most likely been circling the place like buzzards for weeks. Brian wasn't hearing things, it turns out. Even now, Philip can hear others outside, low voices, twig snapping, and he does the quick mental arithmetic. There are at least six of them, maybe more, and at least four vehicles, and each one seems to be heavily armed with plenty of ammo. Philip can see mags and speed loaders clipped to some of the belts. But the one thing they seem to lack that maybe, just maybe, Philip can work with is the appearance of intelligence. Even the big bald guy, who seems to be the honcho, has the look of a dull stoner in his eyes. There won't be any appeals to mercy, no appeals to the better angels here. Philip has only one chance at survival.
You mind if I say something? He asks. Before you all do anything rash.
The bald man raises his glass as though giving a toast.
You got the floor, friend. We got two ways this can go down, is all I'm trying to say.
This seems to pique the bald man's curiosity. He sets down his glass and turns to Philip.
Only two ways? One way is... We start blazing, and I can tell you how that's going to play out.
Do tell.
You folks will overpower us, and that'll be that. But the only thing is, I promise you one thing. And I'll be honest with you, I've never been so sure of anything in my life.
And what's that?
No matter what, I know that I'll be able to get off a single shot. And I say this with no disrespect, but I will make damn sure that the overwhelming majority of these steel beads go into the top half of your body. Now, sir, do you want to hear option two?
The bald man has lost his sense of humor.
Keep talking. Option two is you let us walk out of here alive, and you take our place with our compliments. And nobody has to clean up no messes, and you get to keep the top half of your body.
For quite a while, things proceed in a very orderly fashion, on the bald man's orders. The junkie couple, in his stricken brain, Philip is coming to think of them as Sonny and Cher, simply back away slowly from Brian and Penny, allowing Brian to lift the child off the floor and carry her across the front parlor to the door. The agreement, if you can call it that, is for Philip and his group to simply walk away from the villa, leaving all their things, and that's that. Brian watches Philip backing out of the house with the shotgun still raised.
Thank God for that piece of shit antique.
Nick follows. The two of them join Brian and Penny in the doorway, and Brian nudges the door open with Penny in his arms. They shuffle outside, the shotgun still aimed at the intruders inside. A number of things flood Brian's senses. The cool wind, the pale light of dawn rising behind the orchards, the silhouettes of two additional gunmen on either flank of the house, the cars angled with their high beams still on like theatrical spotlights heralding the next act of a nightmarish play. The bald man's voice calls out from inside.
Boys, let 'em pass.
The two accomplices outside, dressed in ragged military fatigues and wielding heavy artillery, each man cradles a sawed-off pistol-grip shotgun. Watch with the baleful interest of predatory birds as Brian carefully transfers Penny onto his shoulders, piggyback style. Philip whispers low,
"Stay close and follow me."
They still mean to kill us. Just do what I say.
Brian follows Philip, who is still bare-chested and still has that ridiculous gun raised commando style, across the yard, past one of the watchful gunmen, and toward the neighboring grove of peach trees. It takes an excruciating amount of time for Philip to get everybody across the property and into the shadows of the closest orchard, mere seconds by the clock, but an eternity for Brian Blake. Because now the methodical transfer of ownership has begun to fall apart. Brian can hear troubling things behind him as he hurriedly carries Penny toward the tree line. Brian is still barefoot, and the soles of his feet sting from the brambles and stones. Voices raised in anger drift out of the villa. Footsteps, movement across the front porch. The first shot rings out just as Philip and his group are plunging into the trees. The blast shatters the air and chews through a branch 6 inches from Brian's right shoulder, spitting bark at the side of his face and making Penny yelp. Philip shoves Brian, still with Penny on his back, forward into the deeper shadows.
Run!
He orders them.
Run, Brian! Now!
For Brian Blake, the next 5 minutes pass with the chaotic blur of a dream. He hears more gunfire behind him, bullets sizzling through the foliage as he hurtles through the woods, the watery light of dawn not yet driving away the deeper shadows of the orchards. Brian's bare feet, getting more and more chewed up by the second, dig into the soft undercarpet of leaves and fruit slime, his brain sparking with Roman candles of panic. Penny bounces along on his back, hyperventilating with terror. Brian has no idea how far to go, where to go, or when he can stop. He just keeps churning deeper into the shadows of the orchard. He crosses about 200 yards of wooded shadows before reaching a huge deadfall of rotting timber, and he ducks behind it. Gasping to get air into his lungs, his breath visible in the chilled atmosphere, his heart thumping in his ears, he gently shrugs Penny off his back. He sits her down next to him in the weeds.
"Stay down low, kiddo," he whispers, "and be very, very, very quiet. Quiet as a mouse."
The orchard vibrates with movement in all directions, the gunfire momentarily ceasing, and Brian risks peering over the top of the deadfall to get a better view. Through thick columns of peach trees, Brian can see a figure about 100 yards away coming toward him. Brian's eyes have adjusted to the wan shadows well enough to see that it's one of the dudes from outside the house, the pistol grip shotgun jutting up and ready to rock. Others are threading through the trees behind him, a shadowy figure coming toward the dude at a right angle. Ducking back behind the rotted timbers, Brian frantically weighs his options. If he runs, they'll hear him. If he stays put, they'll stumble upon him for sure. Where the hell is Philip? Where is Nick? Right then, Brian hears the rhythmic snapping of twigs in another part of the grove speeding up, somebody moving quickly toward the gunman. Peering over the top of the deadfall, Brian sees the silhouette of his brother, 50 yards away, creeping low through the undergrowth, coming at a right angle toward the shooter. Brian's spine goes cold with dread, his stomach clenching. Nick Parsons appears in the shadows on the other side of the gunman with a rock in his hand. He pauses and then hurls the stone, which is the size of a grapefruit, 100 feet across the orchard. It bangs off a tree, making an enormous clapping sound which startles the gunman. The dude whirls and squeezes off a wild shot at the noise, the sonic boom waking up the orchard and making Penny jump. Brian ducks down, but not before witnessing, almost simultaneously, a blur of movement streaking toward the gunman before the dude even has a chance to pump another shell into the breach. Philip Blake bursts out of the foliage with the old double barrel already in mid-swing. The petrified wooden stock strikes the gunman square on the back of his skull, hitting him so hard that he nearly flies out of his jackboots. The pistol grip shotgun flies. The gunman lurches and sprawls to the mossy earth. Brian looks away, covering Penny's eyes as Philip quickly, savagely, finishes the job with 4 more tremendous blows to the fallen gunman's skull. Now the balance of power subtly shifts. Philip finds a thrown-down pistol, a snub-nosed 38, behind the fallen gunman's belt. A pocket full of shells and a speed loader give Philip and Nick another boost. Brian watches all this from the deadfall 50 yards away. A surge of relief courses through Brian, a glimmer of hope. They can get away now. They can start over. They can survive another day. But when Brian signals to his brother from behind the deadfall, and Philip and Nick come over to the hiding place, the look on Philip's face in the pale light sends a sharp dagger of panic through Brian's gut.
"We're gonna take these motherfuckers out," he says. "Each and every last one of them."
"But Philip, what if we just..."
"We're gonna get this place back. It's ours, and they're going down."
"But listen to me."
Something about the way Philip locks his eyes onto Brian's make Brian's skin crawl.
"I need you to keep my daughter out of harm's way, no matter what. Do you understand what I'm saying?"
"Yeah, but that's all I need you to do."
"Okay, just keep her safe. Look at me.
Can you do that for me?"
Brian nods.
"Yeah, absolutely, Philip. I will. Just don't go and get yourself killed."
Philip doesn't say anything. Doesn't react. Just stares as he pumps his shell into the pistol grip 20 gauge. Then gives Nick a look. In a matter of moments, the two men have sprung back into action, vanishing into the grove of trees, leaving Brian to sit in the weeds, weaponless, petrified with fear, frantic with indecision, his bare feet bleeding. Did Philip want him to stay put? Was that the plan? A gunshot thunders. Brian jumps. Another one answers, the echo boomeranging across the cold heavens above the treetops. Brian clenches his fist hard enough to draw blood. Is he supposed to sit here? He pulls Penny close as another gunshot rings out, closer. The muffled, strangled sound of a watery death gasp reverberating after it. Brian's thoughts begin to race again, the tremors rocking through him. Footsteps crunch toward the hiding place. Brian ventures another quick peek over the top of the timbers, and he sees the creepy bald dude with the 9mm Glock weaving quickly through the trees. Coming this way, his scarred face burning with killing rage. The crumpled body of the skinny kid named Shorty lies in the mud 100 feet to the north, half his head blown away. Another blast makes Brian duck down, his heart in his throat. He's not sure if